Welcome to Embracing Continuous Behaviour Change for Anger Management, the podcast that helps you to calm your emotions and communicate effectively. I'm your host, Claire Broadley, the Anger Management Coach. In this podcast, I'll bring you expert interviews, inspiring stories, and practical advice on calming your emotions and living a more peaceful and fulfilling life. So sit back, relax, and get ready to master your emotions. Good morning. Thank you for listening to the Anger Management Coach podcast. I'm Claire Broadley, your host, and this morning I have a guest with us, David Breakspear. David, thank you so much for agreeing to be on our podcast this morning.
You're welcome, Claire. Good morning. Good morning, everyone.
What a beautiful day to be stuck in a house and recording a podcast.
It is, but I think the heavens are about to open here down in Kent. So, it's about to get wet and extremely wet.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, well, I think we had a thunderstorm last night.
We've got ours on the way.
Right. I slept through it. So, David, thank you again so much for agreeing to be a guest.
You're welcome.
Would you mind just giving me a bit of, well, giving us a bit of a background as to you're involved with, is it a charity, Revolving Doors?
It is, yeah.
So just give me a bit of background, or not even a bit, as much background as you want to, and then how you became involved with Revolving Doors.
It's a long story.
Will you take your time then?
Well, yeah, I mean, to be honest, my story isn't that unique. It's not untypical for people who are trapped in the criminal justice system also share. I suffered from child abuse at a young age. I then had an acquired brain injury again at a young age, excluded from school at 14. I spent my first time in custody at the age of 15, which continued throughout my life in and out of prison. And then to cut a long story short, and we can obviously talk about things, but to cut a long story short, otherwise we'd be all day with my introduction. In 2015, I was on my ninth and what I wanted to be my final ever prison sentence. And I used that sentence to really provide me with the tools that I needed in order to turn my back on a life of crime and a revolving doors of crisis and crime. Yeah. And one of the things that I wanted to do whilst I was in prison, I had this, the thought, I wanted to use my lived experience because I utilized it in prison in certain ways, but I wanted to use it when I become a member of society by hopefully influencing change. As you said to me before we started recording, that everyone has a story and everyone's story is important. And I think it's through listening to other people's stories, we get to hear about the real parts of life rather than kind of the versions that we get to hear and see on the media. Kind of in a nutshell, that's me and where I am. So I'm happy to answer any questions, Claire.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I was just about to pick something up on what you'd said. And it's gone straight from my head, so hopefully that will come back. So, and as you said, we hear about perfect lives, don't we, on social media, about how everyone's living their best life, et cetera, et cetera. And that, as you have just said, is not the reality.
It's not.
For anyone, really, we can't be living such amazing lives. You know, life does get in the way. And as you said, as a young child going through childhood abuse, how on earth did you manage that? Were there people around to support you?
Well, obviously, I clearly didn't for a number of years. And no, there wasn't. Obviously, I never divulged it. And again, that's not uncommon. When you speak to people, I'm 55 this year, and when you kind of speak to people my age and slightly older, a lot of people went through abuse, whether it be physical or sexual abuse as a child. As I say, it's not an uncommon trait, especially for people who are in the criminal justice system. Even people now, teenagers and young people are going through those same sort of things. And also with school exclusions, obviously there's a school to prison pipeline, and once you're excluded from school, there's a good chance that you're going to end up in the criminal justice system. And there's all these things that we know about, but it's about what's being done to prevent it from happening. We know how to prevent it. Why aren't we preventing it? And I've kind of forgotten your original question, so I'm sorry there, Claire.
Right. I think it's more about how you manage to be resilient in that time. Correct.
Yeah, I don't know. In later life, I was diagnosed, 14 years ago, I was diagnosed with ADHD, along with several personality disorders. So I suppose in a way, without knowing, those personality disorders, my ADHD, may have been responsible for me getting involved in crime, but they might have also been responsible for me to be able to survive life. It's very difficult for me to kind of say how I just did. I wasn't living life, I was surviving life, of course, but I don't know where that resilience comes from. As I say, it's probably because I wasn't your neurotypical person, your normal person as such. I had a lot of things going on from a young age, and I think people were too quick to label me. I was the youngest of six, so it wasn't often that I was called by my own name. I'd be called one of my siblings' name by my family first, and that wasn't just at home. And I'm not complaining. I had a great childhood at home, as even though I was the youngest of six and everything that come with that. Obviously, there's a lot of battles between siblings that went on. But going through the school system, the same thing was kind of happening, and it's, you're not like your brothers, you're not like your sisters. And that went on for a number of years. And at the age of eight was when I was started to be sexually abused. It wasn't by anybody at home. It was a local toy shop owner. I mean, he had the perfect environment to become an abuser and to groom children. I mean, a toy shop, what more could you ask for? And that lasted for nearly a year. And then, as I say, at the age of 10, I contracted meningitis. And it wasn't long after that that I started getting in trouble with the police and found myself receiving a caution at the age of 10. And everything sort of went downhill from there, really. But no, there wasn't much support. Whilst I was getting in trouble as a child and as a teenager, I was obviously being sentenced to certain orders by the courts, but they were more to interrupt and disturb my life, criminal activity, rather than to intervene and to really see what went on in my childhood. No one really asked. It was, as I say, everyone was too quick to label me. I was labeled challenging and disruptive, the troubled kid, all those sort of things. And they were labels, especially for someone, again, I was the youngest of six, so having my own identity was very difficult. Finding my own identity was very difficult. So when the system itself, the education system, as well as society and people at home, started labeling me with those negative labels, they gave me an identity.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying that that's the case, but it's quite, it's a coincidence that I kind of become the labels that I was wearing. And it took me a long, long time to be able to shake those labels off, because you see yourself as the labels you're given. And it's very difficult then to see yourself in any other light, as I often saw myself as scum, as pond life, as living in the gutter. I couldn't see myself as a better person or as the person I am now. I could never see that. However, I managed to gain that knowledge of who I could be throughout my journey in prison. I become a better person in prison, not because of prison. But because of the kind of roles that I did, and I volunteered for an organisation called Shannon Trust. They're a charity who train people in prison who can read to teach people who can't or who struggle to read. And it's an incredible service, absolutely incredible. I dread to think what our system or our prison system would be like without Shannon Trust. But then there are many, many other charities that do support people in prison. I become a listener for the Samaritans. But then on the other side of that, I become an education mentor in education, believe it or not. And those jobs kind of gave me a lot more compassion and understanding and empathy towards the people that I was speaking to and the people that I was living next door to and on the same landing and wings as. And when you get to kind of live in that environment, you get to see the other side of people. People put up a lot of front, but in roles as mentor, you get to see past that. You get to see past the mask. Not all the time. You get a few that will keep that mask there because, again, it's a protective thing. It protects you having that mask. I mean, I wore a mask for years, and I think a lot of people do wear masks because they're frightened of unveiling the real self.
And I guess, whilst you're holding that mask, you're keeping that trauma inside, aren't you, as well?
Of course. Yeah, I mean, my trauma no longer controls me. The labels that I were given no longer define me. If you like, I define those labels. Mm-hmm. Going back to education system, the teachers were, I mean, they were right in one thing, that the only place that I'm going to end up is in prison. But it begs the question, it's like, well, where were you in the support to make sure I didn't
go to prison? Absolutely, yeah.
I was a child that was going through so much in my head. My mind was an absolute mess. And of course, I don't know when my ADHD started. It was only diagnosed later on in life. I don't know when the personality disorders started, although I was diagnosed as a school child with antisocial personality disorder. And even then, I didn't understand what that meant because I thought I was a class clown. So therefore, I was quite sociable. I had lots of what I thought were friends at school, but you kind of learn the difference between friends in an environment and real friends. I am social. I don't understand it. And no one really explained it to me. I suppose in a way it gave the school the reason that they needed to finally permanently exclude me after many, many suspensions.
And it's almost like they put you on that path, isn't it? Of, as you said, rather than providing you with the support to move you away and navigate you in a different way,
exactly.
put you on the start line.
Well, exactly. And the thing is, Claire, what I don't want to do is I don't want to put all the responsibility on this, that, and the other.
Because
I've got to accept my own responsibility in all of this. Mm-hmm. Of course I have, because I was the one that was reacting in the way I was. I was the one that was behaving in the way I was. But then I didn't know any different.
Yes.
I didn't know how to express myself. I was a child. I didn't really know how to behave. The behavior that I was picking up was learnt behavior from the people that I was hanging around with. Because they accepted me for me. Again, it's that identity thing at a very young age that being involved in a group of slightly older people at a young age, but as I got older, the group become older. They become men rather than boys, and we were kind of 13, 14, hanging around with 30-year-olds getting involved in crime. But it was the camaraderie. I mean, we never really earned any money. We'd done some big jobs, don't get me wrong, but that's nothing I'm proud of. But it was what we received out of it. It wasn't about financial reward. We didn't understand about money, really, but we understood about, looking back, it's easy to think about this, but we understood about togetherness. We understood about being wanted and needed and felt worthy. Who doesn't want to feel worthy?
Absolutely.
Now, if that worthiness you're feeling comes from a particular group of people, then obviously it's going to be a negative outcome.
Yeah.
Whereas on the flip side of that, if you're surrounded by inspirational people, motivational people, people that lift you up rather than keep you down, then obviously the outcome's more than likely going to be a positive one.
Yeah. And you mentioned in 2015 you said it was, you'd made that decision, it was going to be your final stint in prison. What was it particularly about that that was almost like your full stop and you saying to yourself,
I'd had enough. I was in a real desperate situation in the community, in society. I was sleeping in a shop, in a church doorway, porchway up in Norwich. And I got to the point where I wasn't sure if I wanted to live or die. I obviously chose to live. But I didn't want to carry on living the life that I was leading. And I knew that the only place that I could really sort myself out was in prison. I tried to get myself help, whilst I was homeless. But there's so many barriers and hurdles you've got to overcome. It's very difficult, especially when you have a past like mine was, which includes violence and kind of robberies, things like that. So I wasn't sort of... I wasn't a low risk, so therefore I couldn't be temporary housed in situations. And so it really did have an effect on me. And as I say, prison for me in that instance become, I suppose, my saviour. And it gave me the platform, the steady platform, believe it or not, even though prison is in the state it's in, but it gave me the steady platform to be able to build from. And well, here we are today. So it speaks for itself what I was able to do.
Yeah. And from what you said, you've got given so much support in prison. And like you said, listener for the Samaritans, helping people to read, doing all the educational stuff. And it seems like prison is where everyone gets the help or can get the help. And actually, they shouldn't be getting that long before.
Well, exactly. Exactly. And let's not forget, apart from education, which is kind of a private area, it's run by the private industry, what was I going to say then? what was it you said then, Claire? Sorry.
We go into prison and we get a lot of support in prison.
Yeah, we're relying on charities to do it. And that's the thing as well. If you took out the charities from our prisons would be in a completely different state. I mean, they're bad now. My God, would they be terrible places. Yeah. Because it's not offending behaviour courses that work as such. It's not what the government and the Ministry of Justice spend millions and millions of pounds on that works. It's connection.
Yeah.
It's learning from others. It's the communication that goes on in prison between peers. You'll find that there's a lot of people who become mentors in prison. They may do it for reasons that might be a case of something to do. But the growth that, I mean, I didn't realise the impact it would have on me becoming a mentor. I didn't do it because of the impact it was going to have on me. I did it because I had lived experience. Mm-hmm. I did it because I cared about the people around me. And I did it because it was something to do in prison and something good to do in prison.
Yeah.
But the benefits that I actually received from it, as I say, were so unwitting. I become a better person, but in prison. As soon as I was released from prison, I was kind of back in amongst it all and I couldn't cope. I couldn't hold down jobs. I couldn't hold down relationships. I was a crap father. I'd let my children down. I mean, I was a nightmare, basically. I was all over the place. And it was about that. There was one thing that really did have a massive impact on me, and it was on my last prison sentence. And I was in a prison library and I saw a quote from Marcus Aurelius that said, "You only have power over your mind, not outside events. Realize this and you'll find strength."
Yeah.
And although I was on the right path to change and ready to change, and I think it was because I was ready to change that it had such an impact on me.
Yeah.
But as I thought about those words, it kind of made me think about other things. And I was spending a lot of time thinking about what is and what was and blaming what is and what was, rather than kind of look forward at what can be. It's kind of, I won't say it was an epiphany, because as I say, it took a while to kind of, and I was already on that sort of in that frame of mind. But I kind of looked at the word rehabilitation more and understood that it wasn't a thing. It wasn't a destination. It was an attitude. It was a mindset. And as I say, with Marcus Aurelius' quote as well, it started to give me a lot of strength. It started to give me a lot of courage to do things I may not have previously done. It set me, it kind of validated the position that I was in, but it really did set me on a kind of, I don't want to say a spiritual path, but it set me on a kind of learning path, learning about myself. Someone recently said to me, we are the lessons to learn. And that really resonated with me, because we are. And being diagnosed in 2010, although they didn't help me at the time, when I was in the right place, in the right mind and the right mindset, I was able to take those labels. And I was able, because when you know how your brain works, and this is something that someone said to me as well, that when you know how your brain works, you can work with it rather than against.
Yes.
And for most of my life, I'd been working against my mind. Mm-hmm. Or working against myself. So having something like that, those labels, as I call them, did help me to understand me. Obviously, throughout my life, I've been using different coping mechanisms, but the wrong coping mechanisms and the wrong medication. I was self-medicating with drugs, with alcohol. At a young age, I began experimenting with glue and gas.
Yeah.
And then you'd see me in school sniffing thinners off my sleeve of my jumper. It was always trying to shut my head off, if you like, and acting the clown, acting up in school, playing up in school. That all was a distraction from what was going on in my head and the reactions that I was expressing and the behavior I was expressing, again, was because of what was going on in my head.
And it's right in what you said about being understanding how your brain works and understanding how your mind works. Because I worked with, in a previous job, I worked with perpetrators of domestic abuse to get them to change their behaviour. Sorry, there's a truck just driving past, if that's very noisy. And you're right, it was about suddenly understanding, because our mind is very powerful. It can, you know, it can tell us things and we can just go along with that and just think that's normal. But actually, we do have the power to question our thoughts and question our mind and to actually come up with our own opinion on it.
We have that power. I totally accept that. But it's the skills.
Yes,
it's not
absolutely.
An easy thing to be able to do. And one thing that I wasn't prepared for in this one clip or my last sentence was getting a conscience, because I'd been stuck in this mindset for so long. The kind of conscience side of things, well, they weren't part of it. They weren't part of my thought process. So as I was becoming a better person, I started to talk to myself a lot better. I started to give myself more positive self-talk. And then, of course, I started to see the world around me in a better light, the people next to me. I saw them, as I say. And again, I forgot where I was going with that one. This happens a lot, don't worry.
Oh, it happens to me, don't worry about it.
I can explain it now, rather than when things like that happened to me in the past, I'd question, oh, you're stupid. Do you know what I mean? You're like, how can you not finish the sentence off? How can you forget what you were saying 2 seconds ago? How can you forget what the question was? And I used to batter myself and beat myself up over things like that, because I am intelligent, I think I'm quite smart, therefore I shouldn't be doing those sort of things. So, as I say, getting those sort of, it gives you reasons, not excuses. Being neurodiverse does not give anyone the excuse to then go out and commit crime, go, it's because I'm neurodiverse.
Yeah, absolutely. But
there are a lot of people who are trapped in the revolving doors of crisis of crime.
Yes.
And a lot of people in prison who are undiagnosed and don't have that answer, and don't have, therefore, the solution in how for themselves to turn their lives around.
Yeah.
Knowing how your brain ticks, you can then work. You can understand how things are happening, and you can, rather than slate yourself, you can tell yourself why. Oh, it's because this is quite normal. This is what happens,
and that's so powerful.
Of course it is. Yeah, of course it is. I think the words we use, it's like what we say to other people is not as important as what we say to ourselves.
Absolutely.
It's what we say to ourselves that's really, really important. And that's something I learned. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me.
Yeah.
But they do. And they stick.
And
labels stick. Negative labels stick. Positive labels stick. So let's use positive labels. Let's use inclusive language rather than negative labels and stereotyping people.
And that just leads me up to my next question very nicely. So thank you for that. So how do you empower others with lived experience then to have a voice and to contribute to that positive change?
Well, look, for a start, it's about other people. I mean, it might be the wrong thing to look back on, but for me, the riots of 1990, the people in prison at that time made a stand. They took a stand. They had a voice and they wanted to be heard. Yeah. And it isn't because they wanted PlayStations or extra blankets or whatever. They wanted fair treatment. They wanted fair treatment. And that was what the 1990 riots were all about. And of course, it wasn't, although Strangeways is famous for it up in Manchester, it wasn't the only prison that went up in the 1990s. I think there was another, well, I think there was about 13 that went up in all total, but there were seven that were Lord Justice Wolfe inspected or investigated. So, but that made huge changes to the system. Mm-hmm. People in prison started to be getting treated better. And really, there were people before them that were trying to make things better in prison for people in prison. Because if you look back, that's where a lot of the changes have come from. Yes, all right, it might have come from government in respect of law changes and rules and regulation changes, but it has been inspired by people in prison. It actually has been inspired by people with lived experience. That's where that real change comes from. Because the louder that voice is, the more likely things are to change. And although, as I say, it was the wrong way to do things back in them days, they got noticed, they got listened to, they got heard. Things began to change. So it's the history of the shoulder of other people where and why I'm able to do what I'm doing today. And that's a story that I like to tell people because it hasn't just happened overnight. It's become a big thing in the last recent years. But it hasn't happened overnight. It's been building for many, many, many years. And it's good to see. And it's good to see that we now do it through the pen rather than from having to go up on the roof and throw tiles at people. But again, that's something we've had to learn. We've had to learn how to take on the system in the right way. Or I say we, I mean I. That was something I had to learn. I had to take the system on in the right way. So there's people around me as well that empower me, that empower others, because I tell the story of where they are. A good friend of mine, I won't mention his name, but a good friend of mine is the National Lived Experience Lead at the Ministry of Justice, and he spent a long time in prison in the high security estate. So there are people that are trailblazers. And leading the way to make life easier for people that are following through. And that's really what I'm just trying to do. I'm just trying to make things easier for people that are following behind because I know what it was like. I know what was missing in my life or from my life that would have enabled me to have changed my life around a lot earlier. And by telling my story, by explaining my solutions, I hope others will learn from it. And that's what it's about. It's about, you say, empower. I think educating people is just as important as empowering people, because with education, you can empower yourself.
And it's not just about empowering those people, as you've called them, behind you or beneath you.
The people that are following in our footsteps.
The people who are now trapped.
Yeah. And not just the people that are trapped in the revolving doors at Crisis and Crime, but the ones that are coming up behind those. The ones
but
that are in the school.
The services.
Yeah, of course, services.
Professionals. It's about...
It doesn't take much to intervene and ask a child what's happened to you.
Exactly.
It doesn't take much at all. And the chances are that child will tell you.
Absolutely.
Or that adult would even tell you. I think it was Frederick Douglass that said it's a lot easier to build strong children than it is to repair broken men. And I totally agree with that. Prevention is better than cure.
Of course
and it's
it
the
is.
Education.
Yeah.
Yes, it's great. It's like neurodiversity in the criminal justice system has become a thing. And I will mention his name. That's Sir Robert Buckland, former Minister of Justice. He made some huge changes around new adversity in the criminal justice system. And he's leaving a legacy behind, because where we are now to where we were is a huge, huge distance. It's really changing within. But we shouldn't have to rely on the criminal justice system to pick up the pieces of where the education system failed.
Yeah.
All of this should have been done in the education system. No one should be leaving school without the ability to read. No one should be leaving school with undiagnosed conditions.
Mm.
And no one should be excluded from school.
No, and you're right. And when you started this, our podcast today, and you said those that are excluded, the high possibility is that they will end up in prison. And as you said, if we know that, why are we not doing something about it?
Exactly.
When we see someone getting even slightly towards the exclusion, we should be stepping in. There should be something to help.
The system should be, because thankfully, there are a large number of charities up and down our country that are doing some incredible work for children, young people, and adults that are having an effect on crime, that are cutting crime themselves through the work that they do, that are providing people with the support that they need to be able to live a life that's free of crime. As I say, without those organisations and charities, again, I dread to think where we'd be.
Yeah.
But we shouldn't have to be relying on charities.
No.
We really shouldn't. It's brilliant that they exist. And of course, I volunteer for a number of charities. So it's great that they exist, but Revolving Doors, our mission, and another charity, Children Heard and Seen, and a few others, the mission is not to exist. We don't want to exist. We don't want to be here having to do this work. We want the system to do what it needs to do and what it must do in order to reform the criminal justice system and the education system, because it's no point reforming the criminal justice system without reforming the education system, because we just keep feeding people in to the criminal justice system from the education system.
Yeah, and like you said, that's the broken man, isn't it?
It is, yeah, because once you become entrenched in that criminal justice system, it's very difficult. If someone hasn't turned their life around after their first time in custody, the chances are it's going to be years later before they do. And who knows what crimes they will go on to commit. They might be in crime originally for, say, shoplifting or something as low level as that. But then they might be in a couple of years later for armed robbery. Or for robbery, which I was. I'm not proud of that fact. I'm not ashamed of it, but I'm not proud of it either.
Yeah. So, you talked about the system, and you've talked about how the prison system and how it is. And as you said, the people that are listening will not know unless they've been in prison what that is like. So, please tell us, what is it like?
Well, look, I mean, I first, as I mentioned at the start, I went in, my first period of custody was when I was 15. I received 4 months in what was known as short, sharp shock. I was in Blunt House Detention Centre in Kent and Eastwood Park Detention Centre as it was then. It's now Women's Prison up in Bristol or Gloucestershire. So I began at quite a young age. And detention centre, do you know what? If I'd have done a week, who knows what my life would have turned out. But I spent over 3 months in there, and I got used to it. I started to enjoy it. I started to like the, and there was a lot of camaraderie in there as well, but I enjoyed the regime. I enjoyed the kind of discipline side of it, which was something I was not really used to. And everyone receives this, there was a lot of physical abuse that went on, but kind of everyone, you knew the rules. You done your talking when you were spoken to. Whether it's right or wrong, it doesn't matter. But if you didn't, you knew about it. If you banged the weights in the gym, you knew about it. Any mistake or any infraction of the rules, you knew about it. So you soon got used to following the rules. And as I mean, we got taught how to march. how to parade. We got taught, we got given housemaid kits, and we were taught how to sew them, because again, if you had a button missing off your shirt on a Sunday inspection, you knew about it. And so did the dormitory you were in, because anyone that made a mistake or done something wrong during inspection on a Sunday morning, the whole landing, the whole dormitory, whatever it was, would more than likely be in trouble. If one done something wrong, you all got the blame. And but then what that done is that created an environment where the person that got you in trouble would get hurt by us, because obviously you didn't do anything wrong, they did, but you're all suffering because of it. So it kind of, the discipline side of it was great, but also it was kind of, it was a learning experience, put it that way. And it didn't have an impact on me, really. I mean, the day I got released, I was out nicking cars that evening with my mates, so it couldn't have had that much of an impact on me. And I soon found myself in a youth custody estate. And again, that was hard work. It was, I mean, I talk about detention centre as if I had fun there. It was hard. It was really, I mean, you were on edge 24/7. It was very difficult to sleep at night. It was, you was in a dormitory with like 40 other kids. I mean, it was hard. It was a hard thing, but it kind of taught me quite a lot as well. And then youth custody was no different. I mean, although the discipline side of things had been removed, I think Borstal finished in 1983 and that's when it became a youth custody. And so they lost the kind of Sunday inspections. There's a lot of discipline side of things gone. And that made, it was a nightmare. Why I look at Feltham, it's the most violent prison in the country. They are nightmares. They're just... I wouldn't want to go back to one now, and I don't know how, I wouldn't want to work in one either, because they are, they're nightmares. It's as simple as that. Mm. And then I got sent to prison at a young age as well. At the age of 17, I was on remand in HMP Canterbury. It was on B4 landing, which was the YP landing. So there was people younger than 21 there, and we were mixing with grown men. And but again, it was something I learned a lot from there. So in the end, it got to the point where I was growing up, or I grew up in a prison environment. So prison in itself wasn't a consequence for me. It didn't become a consequence. It became more of a reward than it did a punishment. Whenever I went back, I'd always know people. If I went back to the same jail that I'd spent time in, like Norwich, I'd go back to Norwich Prison. I spent a number of years in Norwich Prison and went back there a few times. So they knew me. And although there was two sides of me, there was a good side and there was a bad side, I was still up to no good in prison. I was still sort of doing the wrong things. I was still having nights out, which is getting involved in drugs and taking drugs in prison. It never become rehab, if you like, which it can be for some people. But for me, I used to buy people's medication. And as I say, I used to have nights out. Because you just need that escape. You can't escape. Yeah. Well, you can escape prison, but you get a long time for it. But you kind of can't escape prison, and you need to escape prison in your head.
Yeah.
Physically, prison isn't difficult. All right, the food isn't great, but you get fed and you get the opportunity to buy things off the canteen, which is great if you have your money sent in or if you've got a job. If you haven't, you go hungry in prison. And obviously, if you get hungry, you can't sleep properly, and you're hungry, you're not going to be the best in the best of moods.
Yeah.
Of course, you can see then how friction happens when you've got a lot of hungry and tired people walking about the wings that are bored. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Not
doing anything. The devil makes work for idle hands, sort of thing. So, however, you can become used to that environment, and it kind of, prison in a way matched my personality and my character. I enjoyed, I think not all the time, because obviously there are some negative periods of my life in prison, but in the main, I kind of enjoyed my time in prison. And it wasn't something that if I was sitting in a police station or if I was sitting in the court cells or if I was in a sweatbox on my way to prison, that I'd really give it much concern about. In no time, I'll be back in prison mind. Right, as soon as I land, I've got to do this, I've got to do that, I've got to do that. So my mind went, oh my God, I've got to go back to prison or I'm going to prison. It was like, right, I'm on my way to prison. What do I need to do? Right, I need to phone my sister, get me a postal order sent in. Book phone credit, get your £2 PIN phone credit when you get in. There's so much that's going on for your mind that kind of on that journey in the sweatbox, by the time you land in reception, you know what it is that you're going to be up to and what you need to do. There's kind of a process that you go through induction, them sort of things. But again, going back to the same prison, I wouldn't have to go through induction. And within days I'd be working. I'd get old jobs back and things like that. Because I provide a usefulness to the prison. Useful to the prison. There's so many ways that you can do prison. You can go, you can stick two fingers up at it and try and buck the system, but it always wins. You can keep your head down and just keep yourself to yourself like a mouse and like, so no one sees or hears you, which isn't, in my opinion, the best advice to do, because people will judge you and they think you're guilty of something else and they'll question why you're keeping yourself to yourself. But then you don't have to be, there's like being a screwboy or a grass and trying to get on the good side of the staff. Again, that doesn't work either, because even the staff, they might benefit from the information, but they don't like snitches either. Do you know what I mean? Because they could be snitching on them. And snitches and grasses, they bring down the atmosphere. And it's horrible when you know you've got someone that's running at the staff telling them things. But there's also another way, and that's just the sensible way, which is you don't have to be involved in everything. There's if you like, see no evil, hear no evil, do no evil. Do you know what I mean? Speak no evil. There's that side of things. And you just get on with doing your own prison sentence. And that's it.
Yeah.
You stay in your own lane and get on with your own prison sentence. And if you can help the people around you and help keep the landing calm or keep the wing calm, then great. But again, you don't have to be running to the office to tell prison staff what's going on to be able to keep a landing calm. People need information, ironically. and that's what keeps the thing. The example I use is you get let out of your cell at 8 o'clock every morning, apart from weekends. So if I'm standing there at 8 o'clock, expecting my door to be unlocked and no one said anything to me and I'm still standing at 10 past eight, I'm going to be absolutely fuming by the time that door's open.
Mm-hmm.
Not just because of my personality disorders and the way I was in that aspect and my character and personality, but I defy anyone not to get frustrated, be behind a locked door that you think was going to be open 10 minutes ago and hasn't been, and you haven't got a clue what's going on. But if 7:30, 7:45, someone come to my cell or there was a message on the telly or whatever, I received information that I wasn't going to be unlocked until lunchtime.
Yeah.
I might not be happy, but at least I know. And then I can just whack the kettle on, put the telly back on, get my feet up on the bed and then chill out until lunchtime or when the door opens.
Yeah.
So it's just that one simple piece of information that can make a whole difference to that prison.
You can manage it.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously that isn't anything to do with people in prison themselves. That's down to the staff to ensure that that happens.
Yeah.
But on induction, it's usually people in prison themselves that are helping people that have just arrived in prison. Sometimes you get the wrong people doing it and giving them the wrong information and things. Like, I mean, we have a laugh as well. So don't forget to ask for swimming tokens and put down for swimming lessons on a Sunday or the tennis or go for a run outside the wall. I mean, you'd have fun with people like along those lines, but it was done in jest, not in derogatory. Yeah, not in malice.
Yeah.
It's a funny old environment, prison. I mean, it can go off at the drop of an hat. But in the main, prison's quite boring. But when a wing's running well, when a landing's going well and everyone's getting on and people are helping each other, it's just a wonderful community to be a part of. And you're talking about murderers, armed robbers, people that have committed crimes like that, that the public only get to hear about the crime. They don't get to hear about the person.
Yeah.
You might get to hear a few mitigating. And I'm not in all cases, obviously. There are some nasty people out there. But there are some people out there that have just made one mistake or become so desperate that they've got involved in the wrong thing. Or they've become so desperate they needed to find a way out of something and crime was the only way that they could think of because they were so desperate.
Yeah.
And they didn't want to ask for support. They didn't want to ask for help. Asking for help is an important thing to be able to do. It's not something that everyone can do. That's why it's an interpersonal skill. We need to learn how to ask for help before we do find ourselves in those situations. And when you get to hear the stories of the reasons why people are in prison or the reasons why their lives are the way they are, it's quite emotional. And if the public got to hear the real stories, they'd probably be more upset than angry at the people in prison.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not talking about everybody, but the vast majority of people in prison. I mean, James Timpson, the new prisons minister, he himself said that 2/3 of people in prison shouldn't be there.
Yeah, absolutely. And that goes back to the support that we talked about at the start of our podcast today. If people were given the right support, the right guidance, and navigated in the correct way,
exactly,
they'd probably be living completely different lives.
Exactly. And when you look at things now that work for people that are leaving prison or for people that have got convictions and are being supported by charities or other third sector organisations that are out there, you get to see the potential that actually they have. And I think it's potential and/or talent that the education system somewhat stifles, because they expect children to all learn in a certain way at the same pace and being taught in the same way as they were 50 years ago. I mean, you look at the exams of 50, 60, 70 years ago, black and white photos, and all the kids are there in lines. It's exactly how they do it now. I mean, it's just, our education system is, for me, in my opinion, responsible for a lot that is wrong with our criminal justice system. We should be doing so much more for our children and supporting our children than we do now. That's the way to reduce reoffending, because we stop offending before it happens.
Yes.
It's very difficult to stop someone, as I say, when they're entrenched in that criminal justice system. And it's a lot easier to stop them before they get entrenched in the criminal justice system.
Yeah.
And that's what we need to focus. Yes, we need to reform the criminal justice system and our prison system. But what we need to do more than most anything else is to reform our education system, because every single child deserves to be successful.
Thank you for that. And finally, what advice or inspiration would you like to share to our listeners, particularly those who might be facing their own challenges within the criminal justice system or within education?
Find out who you are. Be you. I mean, obviously, for adults, look behind the labels. When it comes to children, look behind the labels. Find out the reasons why things are happening. Don't be so quick to judge. Ask, listen. That's the way forward in respect of children. We have to ask children, we have to listen to them, and we have to respect their views and opinions. Because at the end of the day, they're our future. They really are our future. But for people that may be on the cusp of the criminal justice system, it's not too late to change. It's not too late to change. And if you do find yourself in prison, it's not a great environment, no, but there are offers of support there. You've just got to ask for it. If you ask for it, you'll get it. No, asking for help isn't easy. But there are people in there that are serving prison sentences themselves that are also there willing to help. Mm-hmm. And that lived experience, you find yourself talking to people that understand you without you having to say too much. They get it. They understand a look. They understand a feeling. Without you having to explain it. They get it. They've been there. They've worn the T-shirt and they found the way out. That's what lived experience is about, especially for people that are trapped in revolving doors, is to provide a way out. Listen to those that have been there before. It's not about what other people did. It's about what you can do.
Mm-hmm.
Don't look at others and think, oh, I'll do that. Look at others and think, right, they did that. What can I do?
Yeah.
What do I need to do to turn my back on a life of crime? What do I need to do to better my life? What do I need to do to improve my outcome? That's what it comes down to.
Fantastic. David, should our listeners want to reach out to you or want to reach out to Revolving Doors, how can they do so?
LinkedIn or Google. Revolving Doors have their own website. More than happy to connect on LinkedIn with anybody. Happy to answer any questions anyone may have. Revolving Doors. They're an incredible organisation. And you can get in contact with them through all social media platforms.
Great. Thank you so much for being a guest today, David.
Thank you, Claire. It's my pleasure.
Pleasure to speak to you.
Thank you for the platform. It's ensuring that our voices are heard. We need platforms to be able to speak from. So thank you, Claire, and people like yourself that do provide platforms for people with lived experience of the criminal justice system to be able to express their views and opinions. So thank you for that.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Claire.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoy listening to the episode and learn some tips on how to manage your emotions in a healthy way. If you've been affected by anything in the podcast, or if you want to share your feedback or questions, please email claire@angermanagementcoach.co.uk. Thank you for listening, and do remember, you have the power to calm your emotions and communicate effectively.